Sure, a lot of you all have heard Claude in meetings. Claude has 16 years of sobriety and just one of the staples of the How Place as far as I'm concerned. Every time he shares, I just get a lot about it, out of it, because it's simply the truth. And he lives this program. It's not a hobby for him. It is a way of life. And so I think we're really, really blessed to have Claude come up here and share. So I'm going to turn it over to Claude W.
My name is Claude Waldrop, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic. Cost me $35 to have Speedy's leg broke, so. Laughter makes for usefulness, our book says. So I always try to throw in some laughter in here because that's what we need the most. We come from some pretty diverse ways of life and some pretty damn god-awful background sometimes, and some of us have it pretty easy in life, but the one thing for sure is this program works miracles. The power greater than ourselves is what guides us all. I'm to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. For this alcoholic, I was born in Atlanta in 1953, and in Atlanta, I grew up all around here. My family comes from the Blue Ridge Mountains, where we brewed moonshine for generations. And then my grandfather on my dad's side that was brewing the moonshine became a Baptist preacher. And so I've had moonshine, preaching, and snakes rattled over my head. You'll believe in any damn thing they tell you after that. I mean, I'm the last one, the sixth child in our family. We had three older sisters and two older brothers. And so every time something got broke, tore up, or screwed up, Claude did it. You know, and most of the time I did do it. So, yeah, it was... a lot of fun growing up in Georgia in the beginning, because all this stuff that's here now wasn't here, and you could go anywhere around here and see wildlife, and it was not unusual to have to throw some rocks at a bear or two just to get them away from the trash cans around right around here. My dad was an alcoholic. Mom never was. She was just a good old Southern girl, just a good old gal. Still is. She's alive, doing well. But Dad drank. And it runs in our family rampantly. It was just a way of life. I grew up watching people get into fist fights, get cut, get shot, go to the hospital, go to jail, pass out in the yard, wreck automobiles, and die. I mean, they just died from alcoholism, you know, the liver, the kidney, the heart. Some of them were just plain insane and got locked away in nut wards. That was the way I grew up. It was just an alcoholic lifestyle. It was the only normal thing I knew. I can remember the first drink that I took that had an effect on me that changed my thinking about life. I was 4 years old, and Dad's remedy for anything from a snake bite to a severed artery was a double shot of moonshine with a little piece of candy in it to kind of cut it a little bit. And I had some ailment or another, and I was extremely sick in bed, and I'm sweating like hell, and I hurt all over, and it was just awful, coughing. He comes in there, and he hands me this glass of this stuff that looks like water. And he said, "You drink that. You just toss it down. You've seen me do it." And I, hell yeah, you know. He said, "You just toss that down, and you stay under them covers." And I tossed that stuff down, and it looked like water, tasted like shit, and burnt like fire. Moonshine, if you've ever had any, tastes terrible. Once you get that first one down, when it hit bottom, it just exploded, and I got the warm fuzzies all over, man. And I'm 4 years old, sweating under them covers, going, "Man, I'm fine. Everything's okay. I can get out of bed and go play now." That's when it had the effect, that first effect that alcohol had. And I chased that illusion of that warm, fuzzy feeling for them until I was 38 years old. And I always drank for effect, because that's the way I saw the men and the women in my family drank, for the effect. They drank to get rid of this problem or that problem, or because things were good or things were bad or things were just different. They just drank. Most of the men just fought and got crazy and arrested, and most of the women just went to the hospital to take a little rest. Poor dear's got bad nerves, you know. God love her, you know. That was the rich ones on the other side of the family, you know. The rest of us, we just sweated it out in the yard somewhere or something. Yeah. But I have dyslexia. So when I read things, it's a lot more fun for me to try to figure things out because there's a 24-hour-a-day Scrabble game going on up here. If we're driving down the road in the same vehicle and I read a sign over to the side that says on-ramp to the highway, you know, you're reading the same thing that says on-ramp to the highway, my brain every time tells me it says no ramp. And I'm going, wait a minute. Now, there's a ramp there because I can see it, so that wasn't right. And I have to re-scramble that in my head. And this happens all the time to me. So when I came in here and found out that alcoholics have a thinking problem, I'm going, oh, good, there's other people like me. So coming up in school was not an easy task because the numbers moved around on me. The letters were backwards, and the teachers were just hell because they didn't understand anything about that. Nobody knew anything about it, really. They just, you were deemed as being slow and stupid or retarded. And that's the way everybody treated me. And everybody in the family said, you know, that's Claude, he's the stupid one, you know. But when I was 2 years old in family reunions, we used to have family reunions around here, and the Waldrops did. And I was a strange kid even then, before I ever had that drink at age four, because in family reunions, they go, you see that little one there, that little blonde hair? That one's Claude. Watch out for him. He bites. And I have no idea why I did that, because, you know, if I didn't know whether I bit you because I liked you or I didn't like you. I just bit. I don't know. It was, my head's been that way since birth, so I was born like this. All right, that's my excuse. I mean, I was born into an alcoholic family. I was just this way up from the get-go. And in school, I was always the class clown trying to distract from my inability to be able to cope. And I learned that, see, my uncle had one of the only bars between Marietta and Atlanta, you know, so I could go over to his bar, you know, the little bar and grill thing there on Canton Highway. It used to be Jack's place, and I'd fill up, put ice in the coolers, and fill up the liquor, you know, and cut the stuff with water like he said to do and stick it back up there and everything. You know. He would let me take beer and liquor and stick it out the back door for payment. You know, so I was always, after school, I was over at my uncle's place, you know, doing the stuff and sticking stuff out the back door. So I found out right quick that, you know, in the 6th, 7th, 8th grade, nobody else had ability to get a hold of liquor. But you go see Claude, because he had a connection. You know, and that's what I did. I learned how to trade and barter with people. You know, and you had this and that. See, I've done everything that, all mood and mind altering chemicals. I'm one of those folks that was very curious. Better living through chemistry, they called it for a while there, you know. But yeah, so I traded a lot. I learned how to talk to people and be their friend and how to act like other people because, see, I never fit in. Ever since I was 2 years old, I never fit in, and I knew that. I knew my brain worked different from other people's, and I had to learn how it was that you acted, how you dressed, and what you said, so that I could act that way, dress that way, and talk that way to fit in, because I knew that there was something wrong with me. I was different, but I didn't know how and didn't know why. So I always tried to fit in, and I learned how to be that chameleon, like so many of us do. How do you blend in, or how do you change to be like this group of folks and that group of folks? And the whole time I'm drinking, because I was always finding where my uncles or my dad or my aunt or somebody had their bottle hid everywhere I was going, and I could always get a nip anytime I wanted one. And even as an infant back then, the doctors told you, if you got a kind of hyper kid, or if they're breaking in them teeth and they're crying all night, well, you can just take a little beer and put it on a wash rag there, and you take a little moonshine, soak the tip of that wash rag, and put it on their gum, and it'll quit. And, you know, hell, I've had alcohol in my system all my life. Grew up this way. So in high school, I was getting on up around 15 years old, and Dad was in construction, and he drove tractors, so every time I was kicked out of school, which was frequent, or out for the summer, I was on a construction job working. So I learned how to operate heavy equipment, drive dump trucks, and blow things up. I was the youngest blast man on a blast crew in the state of Georgia at the age of 15. Dad handed me 2 sticks of dynamite one day and 2 blasting caps and 50 foot of cord and a battery and said, go figure out how this works because you're going to be the blast man for this summer. And I'm going, oh boy. I think he was really trying to kill me, but you know, we're pretty smart. We figure things out quick. So he heard several explosions out there and kind of wondered how in the hell that I got, you know, like 8 explosions out of 2 sticks of dynamite. Well, I found out with duct tape, you could make your own fuses, and you could cut those sticks into pieces and wrap them with that duct tape, and found a new way to go fishing. Boom! Fish float to the top. Works every time, too. So I was learning how to blow things up a lot and having fun with that. And all my life, I've had trouble with anger. And when I came into this program, I had to go back to what was the root cause of these angers, these resentments, these deep-seated feelings that I had that drove me to do things in life. One of the things that I remember when I was 6 years old was we were poor folks because Dad drank so much. He drank up all the money. And we would live in different places so that we could sell chickens and rabbits and doves and things to people. And at one particular Easter rolled around, and we were selling rabbits. And I had this one rabbit. It was mine. It was on a pin on the end, and I kept it nice and clean and well-fed and everything. And some people were coming around, and several people wanted to buy it, but I wouldn't tell it. I wouldn't sell it. And I kept telling them, no, that one's mine. It's not for sale. And that afternoon, Dad heard me say that to somebody, that one was not for sale. So it was on a Sunday, and it was the custom on Sunday, you go out and get a chicken or a rabbit or something, you carry it over the chopping block, and you cut its head off, gut it, clean it, cook it, and eat it. That was what we ate. So he went out there, and he grabbed my rabbit and took it over the chopping block, cut the head off of it, and made me cut it, gut it, clean it, and take it in the house. Mama fried it up, and he made me eat it. And that's where deep-seated resentment began. I had a resentment against authority figures. I learned that anything that I loved would die, and that you don't trust people, because that started shutting down emotions. If you showed emotions, Dad brought us up to be tough, the boys to be tough. And you would, if you lost a fight when you got home, you got your ass beat for losing that fight. So I learned early on how to shut down emotions and how to be tough and how to you endure no matter what. Several other things along those lines. I had a dog one time. It got hit when I was crossing the road going to school one morning, and she followed me out of the yard and got hit, broke her 2 front legs. I had to carry her back home, put a bullet in her and kill her. I had to take her out back and bury her. So pets didn't do well with me. You know, I had to learn it, you know, you shut down those emotions and all this, I didn't know how to deal with it, and there wasn't any counseling or anything, and so you just bury it, you stuff it, you bury it. And these things just keep building over time. Over the years, everything just keeps building. And by the time I was 16 and a half, Dad and I got into our last argument, and it took my 2 brothers pulling me off of him, or I would have killed him. I almost beat him to death. And the next morning, he threw me out of the house and went and lived with one of my sisters for a while, and that created a world of crap because her husband was an alcoholic, so you got 2 alcoholics in the house, and it didn't work real well. Eventually, I wound up joining the military. I went into the Air Force, and at the time, it was the middle of the Vietnam draft era, and you either joined the military or left the country or just dodged it all the best you could. So rather than go directly to Vietnam, I joined the Air Force. And I signed up in the Air Force to go to be a mechanic, a jet plane mechanic. And they tell you, oh, yeah, whatever you sign on that dream sheet, you'll get. Yeah, we'll make you a big lie there. Somebody in military intelligence, and I still believe those are 2 words you shouldn't use together because they just don't work, decided that they were going to form a new top security network within the Air Force, and they took 260 of us, which is called a flight, and they said, you're all going to be special security, top-level security police. And I'm going, this is interesting. Now, you take a street hippie from Atlanta who's an alcoholic and a drug addict, and you give them a gun and a badge and the keys to an entire base, you know, and authority with 1 stripe to shoot and kill 4-star generals if they do the wrong thing. And I'm going, hell yeah, I like this. And that's what they did. That's exactly what they did. And the sergeant was riding me around the base, and he was, because I had these guys that I was over these guys, man. I had this crew of guys that were my guys, man. We all trained together, and they cross-trained us through all branches of the military so that we could function with everyone worldwide. And they took these 260 guys, and they spread them out on all the top bases around the world. We bumped the CIA for the satellite. The next satellite that went up pissed the CIA right off. But we got the next satellite, so we could communicate and do anything we needed to around the world. And the sergeant's driving me around base, and there's this key ring about this big, and I got about 1,000 keys on the damn thing. He's going through every top security building and every lock and everything, and he's telling me all about this stuff. And we get down to one last key, and I said, "Well, Sergeant, what is this key for?" "Oh, that's the liquor warehouse." Going, "Oh, really?" "Well, we have to make sure that's secured tonight." Drove right over there and checked that puppy out. Made a copy of that one. Kept that with me, man. I never paid for liquor the whole time I was in the military. It was absolutely insane. There were a lot of things that went on in the military during those years that they still don't want the public to know about, and I had to sign a disclosure agreement on that. But there's some things that they have let out that I can talk about, and one of them was, I don't know if you might remember, Oliver North had a little thing going with the Contras down in South America at one time, and that was the CIA's little game they had going down there. And Congress, there was a shift in political view, and Congress cut off Oliver North's fundings, and Oliver North was an army lieutenant who had this thing going on with the CIA and this group of paramilitary people out in South America, and Congress cut off his funding. And the CIA still wanted the little war go on, and they were out of money. So what they did was, Oliver North didn't, the Contras didn't have any money, but what they had was cocaine labs all over the jungle. So the CIA developed a little thing called Air America. They bought planes and wrote Air America on them, and they would fly people all around, doctors and nurses and stuff all over South America, and under the guise of humanitarian aid. And while these people were working 2 or 3 days in these jungle environments with these people doing medical stuff, CIA was loading up the planes with cocaine and flying it out. And what they were doing is they were flying it from South America to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, refueling and flying it up to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, where I was. And it was my job to unload this stuff. Life gets interesting when you got the key to the liquor warehouse and a C-130 load of cocaine. And they're telling you there's no orders or paperwork on this. This doesn't happen. This isn't happening. And you're in your barracks asleep. And I'm going, right. Okay, sir. And we were loading this stuff up in U-Haul trucks, and it took 5 U-Haul trucks, big ones, to unload a C-130 of kilos of cocaine, uncut. And you can't put a damaged product in a U-Haul truck because someone may find out, that it's not just some sort of powder, it's cocaine. So everyone that got broke while unloading the plane, I just had a duffel bag sitting there, and I'd wind up with 10, 15, 20 keys. Twice a month. And that's fine with everybody else. They'd go sell the drugs to the mafia in downtown Dayton, and they'd go buy all the guns and weapons and ammunition and medical supplies they needed, and they'd come back the next night, and we'd load up the plane, and they'd fly it off again. So there was absolutely no way to stay clean and sober in the military. Not for me. It was an absolute impossibility. And it, by the way, this never happens. And I'm going, oh my God. So the insanity ensues. I was in there for 3 years doing this stuff. And they had us doing other things that I found my conscience could not endure. You don't kill Americans on American soil with American troops for political and monetary gain. And on that I drew a line, because I couldn't drink it away. I couldn't sleep. It got to a point to where the actions that they were having me do, my men carry out, were morally incorrect. There's one thing to go to do something for God in your country, and there's quite another thing to go do the wrong thing for money and for politics. So the shit hit the fan one day, and I wound up in front of a special board of review, and they had to let the media in because it was such a big problem. And I was ordered to lie about the things that my crew had been doing. It was called Special Black Ops. And I didn't lie. I had the opportunity to stand before a room of 100 people and 15 reporters and tell the absolute truth. And nobody could stop me because the media was there and they were writing everything down and recording. I told the truth. And I was told the next day that I had orders to Aviano Air Force Base in Italy. And I called a friend of mine that night who was one of my co-workers in Aviano Air Force Base in Italy. And I told him, check out the number of these orders and find out what's going on with that person. And he did. He called me back in 30 minutes. He said, well, the guy that's carrying these numbers for these orders is to die in an automobile accident 2 weeks after his feet hit the ground here. He said, why? What's up with these orders? And I said, they're my orders. He went, oh, shit. He said, what's your other option? And I said, dishonorable discharge. He said, if you want to live, you got to take the discharge because it's my orders to get rid of the guy who's carrying these orders. And I said, I understand. You're doing your job. He goes, yeah, I hate it, buddy, but that's the orders. You follow orders. So I took the dishonorable. And I have paid for that for the rest of my life. I have no benefits or of any kind or anything. But it helped get me to where I am now. It takes whatever it took to get you where you got to. I had fathered a child when I was in the military, but I was, at the time I'm on cocaine, I was also doing heroin, I was drinking heavily, and I was not father material at all. And the lady gave the child up for adoption, and I have never seen or heard from him. I have no idea if the boy is still alive. And that is something that is on my nightstep amends, that I am willing to make an amends should God put me and him together. You know, but there's some things that you just trust God with, and you leave it at that. And that is really where you have to do. I mean, for me, I have to just trust God with things and let them go. And they will work the way that God just wants them to. I created a lot of havoc when I got out of the military because they took a homicidal and a suicidal person and turned him loose on the streets. Now, remember, all this guilt, shame, remorse, and rage has been building all this time. And when I hit the streets in Atlanta, I could put a bullet in you without flinching and didn't bother me at all because, remember, the emotions shut down a long time ago. Long time ago. Didn't care. Even the people that grew up with me around here knew me. They knew that if I walked up to you, when I got off of that Harley, and I used to ride Harleys a lot, when I climbed off that Harley and walked up to you in a bar or out in the open, you never knew whether I was going to give you a handshake, pull out a gun and shoot you, or cut you with a knife. It's just how whatever crossed my mind is what I did. It was instant reaction. I never stopped and thought about anything. I was taught by the military, the thought comes through, you react. No matter what it is, you do it. And it was always about kill. That was just it. They program you, that's the way you are. And they didn't deprogram me when they threw me back out on the street, so they turned this thing loose on society. I rode around here and terrorized this place in the Atlanta metro area for many, many years. And they decided that one day the Cobb County judge sent the sheriff out of my apartment and woke me up, told me to go to his chambers. I stepped in the Marietta judge's chambers, and I was expecting to see the one judge, and I know I ain't done nothing. I don't know why he wants to see me. And there's five judges sitting in there, and they're all from the Atlanta metro area. And they said, we want you to take a vacation. And I said, oh, really? They said, yeah. we want you to leave the state of Georgia for 2 years because we're tired of you. And they started reading off lists of offenses in this county, beating up the cops, tearing up the cars, running crazy on that Harley. If a red light turned red in my direction, I'd just pull out a 38 and shoot the light out and go on. People wrecked behind me. I didn't care. It was just plain insane. I just ran loose. So they decided that I needed to take a vacation and leave the state for 2 years. And I said, well, what's the other option? What if I don't? And they said, we are prepared to lock you up in the Georgia Regional Mental Institution for an indefinite period of stay. And I said, then when did you want me to leave? They said, you've got 2 days. Well, then one day I sold what little I had, jumped on the Harley, took off up to Virginia to a friend's who was in the Navy SEALs, and proceeded to party for 2 years in Virginia Beach with Navy SEALs. We go in, tear up a bar. They ask you to leave. We leave. We go tear up another bar. I mean, it was just fun. This is the lifestyle that I had. It was just plain insane. Drinking the whole time, anything and everything. Anything went. Didn't matter. There was a time when I hooked up with some people once I got back to Georgia where I had a nice place to stay. I had fast automobiles, nice bikes, good-looking women who were models out of Atlanta, modeling agency, escorted me around all the time. And I had, any given day, $60,000 is what I spent every night. Just 60 grand. That was pocket change. Every night for 2 years. And I remember standing on the balcony at Riverbend looking down there at a party that was going on in my place there, and I'm looking down at my little fast cougar car and my Harley down there, and this good-looking woman by my side, and I'm standing there with a fifth of Jack Daniels and a 38, wondering which one I want to take first. Because I got all the money, I got all the stuff, I got everything, and I feel like shit on the inside. Because I'm wondering why I have no ability to love this person beside me. It was just a person. It was just another thing. And I'm going, this ain't right, man. There's something wrong with you. There was. So things continued on, and I got worse and worse and worse and lost all the stuff 3 times over. There toward the end, my sister was having me arrested and put in Georgia Regional Mental Institution. And 3 months before I came to AA, I was in Georgia Regional. And I came to that morning in a mental institution in a straitjacket, sitting in a padded room going, oh my God, is this what's going to be going on for the rest of my life, in and out of mental institutions now? What happened? What happened? And it was devastating. I managed to, as a good alcoholic and insane person, I talked my way out of there in 24 hours. It was amazing. They thought I was perfectly sane, you know. By the time I left there, it was absolutely amazing. I want to back up a couple of years and tell you about a very special event that occurred in my life, which ties all of this together for me. As you can see by the way I dress, the way I talk a lot of the times, that I'm Scottish, Irish, and Cherokee. I thought I could drink, too. Well, what the hell? It's a thinking problem, right? Yeah. So I believe in a Native American point of view of the great spirit that moves through everything and that God lives in everything. And I was working for a company in 1974, October the 18th. It was 12:30 in the day. We were putting in the first fiber optic cable that was running in the state of Georgia at Roswell Road and Soaps Creek, one of the ditch jacks that were holding the ditch back failed, and it caved in on me. There was 2.5 tons of dirt that broke 22 bones in 2 seconds. The only thing sticking out of the ground was that much of the right hand, and from my jaw up, just my head. And I remembered I could not breathe, and then the sound stopped. And I floated back up out of my body. And I'm watching all these guys run around this head and this hand trying to dig it out. And I thought to myself, that's me down there, and this is me up here. And then it crossed my mind, I guess, that, wow, you can still think. The spiritual self can still form idea and opinion. And I'm going, well, this is different. And I'm watching me down there and them digging me out. And it's like I turned and looked up into the sky and everything went to 1,000 points of light. And I started flying up through this tunnel really fast. And my dad had died a year before. And when I came to a stop at the end of that tunnel, I noticed two things immediately. Time no longer had meaning at all. It just stopped. And that my dad was present. And he said, Claude, it's okay. Everything's going to be all right. And I knew it would be. And then this entity appeared in front of me, this brilliant white light. It's indescribable. And a feeling of love and joy and happiness and care that is indescribable. And I felt as though I was in these two huge hands and he had stopped everything he was doing to see what was wrong with Claude. You see, what I didn't know was that was my original checkout date. That was the date that I was supposed to die, that I had done what I was supposed to do up to that point. And the first question he asked me was, what have you done for my children? Since then, I've talked to thousands of other people who've had the similar experience, and they've all related the same thing to me. He asked you, what have you done for his children? Your whole life goes before you and everything is known instantly. And then he cleaned the record, and I was not a nice person. And he said, it's okay. You can stay here or you can go back. It's up to you. He gave me a choice. And I felt as though in the Native American point of view, the circle of life hadn't been completed. I had only been part way. There were things left undone. And I wanted to come back. He said, go back in your body and fight to live. You have work to do. So I did. I went back through the tunnel and I came to a stop. And I'm floating in the air and I'm looking at them digging this body out. And they've got it just about down to the waist dug out. And it's very badly broken up. I remember thinking, man, this is going to hurt. And sure enough, it did. I went back into my body and I coughed real hard and all this dirt and blood came out. And they pulled me up out of that ditch and the arms and the legs were in the wrong place. The left shoulder was ripped almost all the way completely loose. It was over here on the right shoulder, the sternum that goes down the middle of your chest that holds your ribs together. It was broken. The hips, the pelvic arch is broken, the coccyx, the tailbone, fingers, toes, legs, everything. Everything. They load me up in the hospital in the ambulance, and the guy in the back was putting oxygen on me and strapping me down and yelled up at the drivers. We hauled ass for Kennestone Hospital, and he said, hey, Frank, take your time. This day going to make it. And I'm thinking, you SOB? I just came from the big guy, and he told me that's going to be okay. But it's hard to tell them that when you got a broken jaw in three places, and you just, so. I was the first trauma team patient that they formed at Kennestone. I was under Bell Telephone's insurance at the time, and they had already called ahead, and they flew three doctors in to Kennestone from the other hospitals in Atlanta, and I was the first person that they had formed a trauma team for at Kennestone Hospital. And I came in there, and they fell in on me, and they started putting chest tubes in and stuff, and I thought, okay, this hurts even worse. And they got me now, so I'm going out, and I just passed out from the pain. And it took 3 years of intensive therapy to get me to where I could lift my left arm, because they told me this would never work again, the left arm would never work again, and that I would walk with a bad limp on the left side and I'd never hold a decent job. It took 3 years to be able to touch my nose and my index finger. I had to learn how to walk, I had to learn how to chew, I had to learn how to crawl, I had to learn how to talk, I had to learn how to do everything from the beginning. Now that experience taught me there is a God. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind there is a God. There is but one ultimate authority, and he loves me. He cleaned the record and let me come back to try again. But being what I am, from 1974 to 1990, I still drank and drugged the way that I did, and that's why I wound up in Georgia Regional Mental Institution 3 months before I came in here. I got to third stage alcoholism, to where if you don't have a drink about every 20 or 30 minutes, you start having DTs, you hallucinate, you start seeing all kind of things that ain't there. Snakes with wings, you know, spotted rabbits with fangs, just all kind of things. And if you don't get a drink when you go into DTs, then you start going into convulsions and they're uncontrollable. And if you don't get medical help, you die of a seizure. Your heart quits. And I was at that stage. And I was drinking because I had to drink. It had long since stopped the ability for me to be able to control it years ago. I couldn't just quit every once in a while. I had to drink. All this guilt, shame, remorse, anger, and rage and everything was there constantly, 24 hours a day. And the alcohol and the drugs slowly quit working. And I'd reached a point to where I decided one evening to end it. And I went and got as much liquor and beer and drugs as I could buy with $1,000. And for 48 hours, I drank and drugged as much of it as I could, and it had absolutely no effect. It had quit working completely. Do you know what's worse for an alcoholic, an addict, when all that stuff quits working? Nothing. That is a hell that no human being can endure. I had created it myself. And I couldn't stop it, and I couldn't live, and I couldn't die. All I had was this pitiful existence stuck in my head 24/7, and nobody wanted anything else to do with me. Nobody. Family, friends, everyone had just written me off. So I got to the point where I started to take a very large knife and put it through my heart. And a little voice, remember that little voice that's always in here in the center that tells you not to do things? It said, don't do it. Call your friend. Call Tony. Tony's a friend of mine I grew up with in school, and he did a whole lot of the same stuff that I did in life. But he, when he was in the military, he went through a rehab center for a while because he got pretty bad off. And for years, he'd tell me, if you ever need help for that, you call me anywhere, anytime. So I called him, and I'm no good at remembering numbers. I still can't remember my own damn phone number. But that number was crystal clear in my head. I called him. He made it over to my house in record time. He took me to Kenistone Hospital, and they looked at me. Now, at that time, my kidney and the liver are failing. I'm yellow with jaundice. My eyeballs, my skin, everything is yellow. I'm pissing blood. And I shook like this 24 hours a day. Uncontrollable. I just shook. I went to sleep shaking like that. I woke up shaking like that. Taking a drink didn't help anymore. I just shook. And I rattled into the emergency room, and they took a look at me and went, my God. But it was during shift change, or close to shift change, for the doctors and the interns that were coming on for the next duty, and they took a look at my blood screen, and they said, we don't believe this. We have absolutely no idea why you're breathing. And this kind of blood decay and this much alcohol and drugs in a system we usually see in the morgue. We do not believe you're breathing. And they, as the shift changed, they brought in the new interns and the doctors that weren't really busy down to look at this guy who was yellow and shaken and had that kind of toxicology report and was still breathing. They'd never seen a case like it before. 2 hours later, my friend had been calling around to the rehab centers to try to find me a place, and I had no money, no insurance, no nothing. And the day before, a guy had signed into a rehab center. It used to be 3 miles down the road down here, down Bell's Ferry, and paid for the entire stay. And that night, he had gotten his Cadillac and wrote a suicide note and drove his Cadillac into an oak tree and killed himself. So I got a bed because this guy had paid for it and committed suicide. I was in that rehab center, and they were giving me drugs to bring me down off the alcohol so I wouldn't die. I remember waking up periodically so that they could give me some drugs to fool the body into thinking that it had a drink to keep me from dying. And they literally followed me around, the staff followed me around for 7 days with a toe tag, betting on what day and what hour I'd die. You don't get any worse than that. That's what alcohol and drugs takes me to. On the sixth day, I came to enough, I choose to think that a moment of clarity hit, like our book says, and I was listening in some of the in-house AA meetings, and they said that if you asked God, of their understanding from the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, to remove a craving and obsession, that he would. And I had tried all forms of religion and all other stuff before, and I was taught the same things that most people are taught about God and everything as a child, but something didn't work for me. So I got honest with myself, and I got down on my knees one night. I also had a problem with claustrophobia from that ditch accident, and that's a state of mind that not a pill or a doctor can take care of. And I'd been by psychiatrists before. They couldn't help me. And I asked God, this new idea of God that they had from this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, if this is what was supposed to be going on with my life and where I was supposed to be, to remove this problem of claustrophobia. I went to bed on the sixth night, and I got up the seventh morning, and I realized when my eyes opened up that that problem was gone. I no longer have claustrophobia, and it doesn't bother me to be in tight places anymore. And that convinced me maybe this was right. Maybe this was real. But to give it another test, you know how we got to be certain about things. You know, on the seventh, that seventh day, on that evening, I got on my knees and I asked this idea of God from the book Alcoholics Anonymous to remove the craving, the obsession for drugs and alcohol. And I went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and they were gone. They have never returned. It's been over 16 years. Over 16 years. And I knew that this was the correct thing to do with the rest of my life, that I was to live this way and to do whatever these people said to do from that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, because it works. I didn't know how much longer I was going to live, but I determined on that eighth morning that this was what I'm to do with my life. And that's what I set about doing. They later sent me to another long-term program, and it took three psychiatrists, a little over 6 months, to get me to be publicly acceptable. Because when I signed into that long-term program, a judge in Fulton County who knew me well, he was one of the ones that threw me out of the state for 2 years, had already signed an order that stated that if Claude Waldrop left the MAR program facility in and of his own accord, that he was to be treated with hostile, if not deadly, force, to be shot and taken down before cuffed, and to be taken to Georgia Regional Mental Institution permanently. I didn't know that when I signed in there. You get a stack of papers 2 inches thick, and you just keep signing until you're done. It took those psychiatrists a long time for us to get down to the root of the problems. And it says to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And we went through every part of my life. And I had to learn what emotions were, what a name was, and basically the description of how it felt, because I didn't know. I had shut down emotions early on as a child, and I knew words, but I didn't know what it felt like in here. And I had to learn how to come to believe that this would work. I knew I was an alcoholic. My life's unmanageable long before I ever got here. All I had to do was try to quit drinking for a while, and I was irritable, restless, discontent, and worse than I was when I was drinking, and that was bad enough as it was. Come to believe that a power greater myself could restore me to sanity? God, I hoped so. You know, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And I understood God. And I knew that he was working in my life because he removed these problems for me. And that they told me that meant that I'm to try to live this, to understand this and live this for the rest of my life. And it gave me in my first book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, all your answers to all your problems are in this book. And I said, well, I'm screwed. They said, what do you mean? And my sponsor knew me because he knew me since I was 9 years old. And he knew my family and my background and my thinking problems. And he said, he's got dyslexia. You can't understand it. So they gave me tapes. And they sit in here for hours. And they'd read the book to me and we'd discuss it. And they'd give me tapes. And everywhere I went, I'd listen to these tapes. And I'd stop it and I'd back it up and I'd listen to it. And it took a year for this stuff to start to stick. Because when I came in here and sat down in that chair right over there where I was sitting when this meeting started, we only had half this room. There was a wall across there. And I sat there and I shook and I cried and I stunk. And the only people that sat around me was my sponsor and four other old timers. They said, "You're the worst case we've seen in a lot of years. You just keep breathing. If God allows you to be breathing tomorrow, you come back in here and we'll read some more to you." And they did. Year after year, I began to live this process as they understood it and as they taught it to me with all the desperation of a dying man. Because, you know, you take the alcohol out and you don't change the thinking and you're insane and you got nowhere to go but nut wards or death. And you can't read and understand this, you're desperate. That's where I was. So I went through my first attempts at these the best that I could, clearing away the wreckage that you told me would happen. And I got the relief that you told me would happen in 4 and in 5. And I did the things that the book said to do in 6 and 7. I did 8. Pain. Dying. To go before some of the people that I had to go before and to tell them where I was coming from the book Alcoholics Anonymous, is a pride-leveling, ego-deflating process. Some people gave me the time to carefully sit and listen to me and to tell me that they forgive me because they know that I was out of control, alcoholic. Other people wouldn't give me the time to even step foot in the door. They said, "You get the F out of my office. Don't even show your face around me again, ever." Some of the women that I've known in my life, I'm to leave alone. I'm never to try to bring up anything to try to make amends. It would do more damage. It took my family members a long time. It took my brothers at least 3 years to where they believed that I was actually trying to change and live this way and that I wasn't drinking and doing drugs anymore and that I could come on their property and in their house, because they wouldn't let me own their property and in their house before, not for years. And that they could turn their back and go into the living room and that I wouldn't be gone when they got back with something out of their house to go sell. It took one of my oldest sisters, it took her 8 years of me living this way before she finally came to the conclusion that my little brother's actually living better now. And he what he's telling me is the truth. And I do step 10 every day. And I carry that little card of the spiritual principles around in my pocket. And I pull it out and I check me during the day. Because I know how my thinking is. And at night, I double-check myself with God, and I make sure that I'm right with Him. And if there is any problem, He will let me know in my sleep. And I found out that I recover from this process physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally. And that I have a conscious and a subconscious disease, dis-ease of mind, body, and soul. And when I got to the point where I was having drinking dreams, then I got to the point where when I was drinking in my dreams, I was picking up white chips. That's when you know that it's sinking in and that this process is actually working. That they didn't lie to me. That what they had told me, the promises that I would get from this process, was the truth. Every bit of it and more. A life second to none. So for 16 years, I haven't chased the money, property, and prestige, and I haven't went out for all the big stuff, because God told me in the first year of my sobriety that I'm going to make you portable, son. I'm going to move you around a lot because I need you to do certain things for me. And I learned early on in the program that if you pray and you ask God for an answer to something, you can expect an answer because He'll give you one. And it's yes, no, or wait. Yes means go ahead and do what you need to do. No is a complete sentence. And wait means that I need to double my efforts with this and with you. Because the only way that I can keep any degree of sanity and peace to be at ease with self is to work with you. You cannot transmit that you do not have. And in 16 years, it's amazing to me that people will actually listen to me. They lean forward in the seat and they go, man, that was great. And I'm going, it's in the book. It's in the book. You can have it too. This is the most amazing process I've ever seen. I was married in the program, married to a lady that had several years in the program, and she got multiple sclerosis. And the doctor wrote her scripts, and she started taking them the way that she wanted to. And she began to get violent, and she quit going to meetings, and I still kept going, and things didn't work. So we've recently gotten a divorce. She finally signed the papers, and I turned them over to a lawyer Friday. So there are not yet that occur in life that you can endure without taking a drink. And you learn to deal with the emotional sobriety. Because if I hadn't had a drink and I ain't had a drug and I'm reasonably spiritually fit, then what's left is the emotional part. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob found that out with the first 100 that they dried out. That if you didn't start working on emotional sobriety of all that guilt, shame, remorse, and pain, and how to connect the right word with the right emotion in here, that all you had was crazy people. All you had was dry drunks, and that wouldn't work. So on a daily basis, I work on me to help you, and you work on what you do to help me. You are me in a different skin. We are the same. We're God's children. So one day at a time, I do whatever it takes to help God's kids. The first thing on my mind when I wake up in the morning, every morning, is that I'm grateful that I'm breathing a sober breath, that I'm not in a mental institution, and that God's given me another day to help his kids. What can I do to help someone else today? And there's always something that I can do to help someone else. And I will do this to the day that I die. Because I don't want any other way to live. I don't know any other way to live. This becomes a working part of the mind. I love it. Got a new job recently. It's working out okay. You know, I do reasonably well. I'm at peace in my own skin. You know, the less stuff that I have, the less things you have to worry about. It's quite freeing. You know, it really is, you know. I got me and a Jeep and some clothes. Woohoo! I like it. People look at me at my life and they go, my God, you're a pitiful wreck. You don't have a bank account? No. You don't have credit cards? Nope. Do you have a phone? A cell phone. Sponsees call me. I call them. That's it. That's all I need right now. You know, that's all I need except you. I have to have you in my life and God. So one day at a time, I've watched this place grow. I've got blood, sweat, and tears in this building that I've helped build these walls, tear out that one in the middle and build those walls back there, smashing my thumb, blood everywhere, help build these right here. I've been here countless hours at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning when another alcoholic would call me up going, man, I'm going crazy. Can you meet me at the house place? And they've always let me have keys to this place so that I could come in here at any time and work with another alcoholic to save my ass. You've taught me love. Something that I never knew. You've taught me self-respect. You've taught me how to love another person just the way they are. So thank you very much.